Welcome back to FemLonk. I know it's been a while, but we couldn't let International Women's Day pass without posting an episode. And today it's episode 50, and I think the episode really does that milestone justice. We're inviting you as listeners to join in on a conversation we had as the FemLonk book club this month. We have author Selena Cesar Chavez join us to talk about her book, Can You Hear Me Now? That was our book club pick this month. And so I start off by interviewing Selena, and then we invite book club participants to join in and ask questions as well. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you get lots of value out of it. And I'll just say, stay tuned. There's some interesting and exciting things in the future for FemLonk. You're listening to FemLonk, a podcast about inclusion, policy, politics, and current affairs. I'm your host, Katie Davey. Thanks for tuning in. Well, Selena, thank you so much for joining us. We're really thrilled. This is the first time that we've had the author join the book club. So, yay! Yeah, so thank you so much. It's really a pleasure. I'm just going to first give a funny hello. So we have a longtime book club member who sends her regrets tonight, but she had a good reason. Her partner, who actually bought her your book for Valentine's Day, proposed to her today. So yeah, so she sends regrets, but she wanted me to tell you how much she loved the book. And I'll share that she also has been a Green Party candidate provincially a few times. So, you know, she's changing the world as well. Oh, but yes, God. Have to start with that.
Does my book have anything to do with the proposal? Because I'll take that.
Yes. Well, it obviously was a clear sign to her that her partner should, you know, is okay to stick around.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's so great. Well, tell her I said congratulations. I'm so excited. I don't even know who she is, and I'm excited for her.
Yeah, I had to laugh. She's like, I'm so sorry. I'm sending regrets, but I have a good reason. And just kind of keeping on funny, like, coincidences, you know, I was scrolling through Facebook today, as I'm sure we all spent much time doing, and I got one of those memories, you know, on this day thing that popped up. And so actually on this day, 5 years ago, I was in Ottawa with the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, CASA, for their lobby week. I was president of the UMB Student Union at the time. And the picture that popped up is actually in your office. So we met actually 5 years ago today.
I feel like we should be drinking to this, like, cheers.
I know, yeah. I know. But like, let me start there actually with kind of a question. Like, if I had have told you 5 years ago when we were sitting in your office that we'd be talking about, you know, the book that you wrote 5 years later at book club, what would you have thought? Start there.
Yeah. So that would have been 2016, early 2016.
Yeah.
So early 2016. So maybe like a month ago, I was just released from hospital for my like nervous breakdown. Right. So I would say, I'm sorry, who are you, lady? And yeah, which alternate future did you come from? Because I don't think that you're talking about me. It's very nice, very kind that you believe that I would be that person that would write a book on, you know, anything at all. First of all, I'm not a writer. I hate writing. So I won't write a book. And first of all, like, a book is long. So who has that kind of time to write all that crap? But thanks. That's what I probably said. Because, you know, I'm really candid in my office. I would have probably said, like, fuck, that's not me. I would have swore something ridiculous like that. But I would have said, I don't think so. That's very generous of you. And I would have said, at some point would have said, oh, no, I should just say thank you for that. Because I always forget to say thank you. But sorry, that's not me.
Well, here we are 5 years later, and that is you. So tell me, like, you know, when did that happen? When did that mind shift happen? You know, what kind of got you down that path to creating this book? And what was that process like?
So to be honest, I had written all these little notes to myself when I was in business. And maybe a year after, you know, a few months after we met 5 years ago, I found that piece of paper that had all these little notes on it that, you know, that I'd written from business, like, never take the first offer. You have to know how much you're worth. God, what an idiot. Why would you do that? You lost thousands of dollars. Oh, if you don't ask, you don't get, you know, you have to give back, blah, blah, blah. And I had all, had this piece of paper. I found it. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I just started writing stories around that thing, you know? And then I started realizing, I've been using some of these lessons in politics. And I was like, kind of been using these lessons on my life. And so, you know, I kind of put it to the side, but as things were happening in politics, I would just write, not write handwriting, I'll put it in my iPad in the notes section. So I have like 700 notes that I just type. Even if you went to my meeting, I would type notes in my iPad. Everything was in notes. And you know, people always talk about journaling and how great it is for gratitude and stuff. And I was just like, that's nonsense. Until you actually do it. And then you're like, this is so therapeutic. This is so awesome. And man, I'm glad I got that out. And so serendipity plays a role. And when the universe unfolds, it kind of like unfolds the way it should. Desiderata, not that line, not mine. And so in March of 2019, I had met my agent and I just thought about writing a book on the lessons that I learned. And then in March of 2019, the week before SNC blew up, like literally the week before, I'm in my auntie's office. She says, let's go visit all the publishers in Toronto during this week. And I'm like, okay, fine. Monday, we go to one. Tuesday, SNC like blow. No, the week before, we make all these appointments. SNC blows up the week before, and I come out and say, I support Jody Wilson-Raybould. All you guys are idiots. I support her. I believe her, right? Like I used the Me Too lines in that whole thing because it was like, I found it so convenient that we were believe her when it's convenient and leave her when it's not. But anyway, I believed her. And so the week after that, I have all these meetings lined up with publishers and they are salivating at this point for a book about how do you come to Canada as an immigrant and then become the leader of a G7 country and then become this loudmouth person. And at that point, I hadn't even sat as an independent yet. And they said, we don't want just the lessons, we want the story. And so in that whole thing, the story, the long and the short of it is because I was so honest during those last few months, my publisher was like, are you going to write an honest story or are you going to leave a bunch of gaps in the story? I was like, oh, I'll leave a bunch of gaps. She was like, no, we're going to write a story that's going to heal. It's going to be honest and it's going to heal. And that's what this is. So it was like the universe was really just intersecting at the right moment, after the right moment, after the right moment. So I had some skeleton of the book, but I didn't actually have this. This took the last year of writing. So from March 2019 to March 2020 is what you see here.
You know, you kind of make the joke about journaling being therapeutic, which, you know, totally agree, right? When you start practicing that, it is. Like this book, it is so honest and it really lays bare a lot of, you know, really difficult things that you experienced throughout your life and including in politics. And I imagine that would have been really like, I can't imagine reliving and putting in paper and then letting the whole world read these really difficult things. Like, can you talk about, you know, where you got the courage, quite frankly, to do that and how challenging that would have been to go through?
So I'm not even sure I still have the courage because there's always tears like right behind my eyeballs. Like I was saying this to someone yesterday, that the tears are always like right behind my eyeballs. They're never far away. So even when like I do some of these interviews where people are like challenging me, I have to like bite inside my cheeks and be like, do not cry, do not cry, do not cry. Because like I did an interview on Thursday night with the Ottawa Library and the guy asking the question was like, so when you were 11, you were sexually assaulted. Can you tell us about that? And I was just like, whoa, like, dude. And he said, what did he say? You know, we couldn't really tell if it was an adult or it was just an older friend or whatever. Like, and he was like, basically, and I was like, I wrote exactly what I needed to write in the book, and it wasn't written for you. It was written for people who had gone through that experience, so they know it's not their fault. They know there's nothing they could have done differently. And for those who feel guilty about going back, I wanted them to know that they weren't alone, and that is not their fault either. So don't ask me any more questions. Like, that was just locked down. So it was hard, but I had to remember who I was writing it for. So people who don't get certain parts of the book, I don't care. People who get certain parts of the book, and every now and again. So I actually wrote the book thinking that everybody should get it. For me, if Black women didn't get this book, I would have been like, oh my God, they don't get it. The miracle of writing an honest story, though, is like I had a young lady, and I can't remember if it was on Twitter because my TikTok is going like nuts today. I can't remember where it was, but she's a white girl, and she's like, just started reading your book. I'm reading the university section and I'm just bawling because this was me. And I'm like, you think that your experiences are all your own, or all women, or all Black women, or all, like, you know, immigrant women. And then it's like, boop, you know, Bill is like, white guy Bill, old guy. He's like, I loved every part of your book. I saw myself in your book. I'm like, Bill, how you seen yourself in my book? Where do you find yourself in this book? And then you realize that there's more about us in common than there is that separates us. And I think when you unpack and peel back the onion layers, it's more of the hurts that we hide, that we think make us so unique, that glue us together.
Like, I assume everyone here on this call definitely saw themselves in different parts of the book. And I know I certainly did as well. Yeah. And, you know, I think in some ways I guess I lead this book club, so I'll let the others comment if this is true or not. But one of the, I think, great and beautiful things about what we've been able to do is we read authors who are different from us, and it lets us in some ways create those shared experiences and empathize and make those connections. And I know, you know, it's been so important, I think, to really being able to kind of digest those topics and themes together and feel a sense of, a sense of empathy and understanding in a way that, you know, as a white woman, I'm not going to understand what it's like to be a Black woman, but I can try to read stories and voices and you know, figure out where some of those commonalities are. I'm seeing a lot of head nodding. So, okay, I'm not crazy.
You know what, though, like when we're coming out of 2020, we're in a global pandemic, we're talking about racial inequality. And in the September 2020 version of the Harvard Business Review, I only read like business periodicals, but Robert Livingston is a professor, and he talked about the ways to increase equity in workspaces, racial equity in particular. And it's a press model, P-R-E-S-S. Forget what the P-R and the S-S stands for, but the E is empathy. And it's really striking that, like, it's such an important component in understanding how to be a ally, how to change the world, because we don't have shared the same experiences. Even if I had a 46-year-old Black immigrant woman standing right beside me, in fact, I had a call with one this morning that didn't go very well, but the even though if we had the experience would be completely different, but at the same time, I need to listen to her story, what she says to me, in the same way that I listen to you, in the same way you listen to my story, and say, oh my goodness, okay. It's not that you have to like it or not. It's not right or wrong. It's not good or bad. It's an acknowledgement, right? I could acknowledge that this is that you've experienced this, and I could acknowledge that this will make you upset. So when you come out of 2020 and you see how many people were protesting for Black Lives Matter, it's because of empathy. It's because they didn't just feel sympathy and say, oh my God, George Floyd died. Maybe we should bake those Black people some cookies. It was, no, we have to, it's beyond our heart is in the right place. We have good intention. Now we have to go out there. We have to like protest. We have to join. We have to act. Right? We have to be anti-discriminatory. So we have to act. And that empathy, that ability to act, act comes from a place of empathy. So it's very powerful. We say the word, but we don't know how powerful it is in creating equitable systems.
And so let's talk about equitable systems, or perhaps unequitable systems. I know you've been doing a number of these conversations, and I've listened to many of them. Of course, as a Politico, one of my favorite pods is the Hurly Burly podcast with David. So I've listened to both of your episodes. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I thought was kind of funny was, David said, well, you are the ideal candidate. I was surprised to learn that you weren't recruited. Like, you're just the ideal candidate. And so tell me a bit about that, like the actual decision to run. We hear all about how difficult it is to get women to run, and we have to ask them, seven times, which is true in many cases, but you said no, you put your hand up and you kind of decided to step forward. What did that look like?
That nobody asked me to run, because it would have made that last phone call with the prime minister like even worse for me to swallow, right? But you didn't ask me, like it was my decision. So I actually owned a healthcare-based research management firm before getting into politics, as you read, obviously. And just the decision, just the knowing that I could help people that were having difficulties paying for medications, paying for the services when they were looking after someone with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or epilepsy, knowing that I could be a part of the policy process instead of sitting on the periphery was part of that decision, into going in. But I didn't think I was going to run. It was just, I would go and, attend a conference or two, the running was no part of the actual thinking until, so that was in December of 2013, February 2014, I become a member of the Liberal Party because I'd always voted Liberal. And then March 8th, I get International Women's Day. I get this email that says, invite her to run. Do you know a woman who'd be interested in running in the next federal election? And I'm like, yeah, my God, this woman right here is dope. And so I'm like, I will do this. And I like did it without any kind of thinking or thought into what actually this means, right? So it's like, well, I mean, it can't be that hard. you'll think about it, because I'm an entrepreneur. You do it as you go, like you build it as you put the bricks down as you're climbing. No big deal. I'm pretty sure I could do it. I at least have my research background, my business background. So no, I wasn't asked, and I just thought, yeah, I know a woman who could do that. I could totally do this. Without any of that background though. So I didn't know you had to ask people. And it was interesting because when Jody Wilson-Raybould was making some of her testimony and she was saying that the prime minister flew across the country to see her, I was just like, that's it. Just the was all I needed, because I was like, that was not me. And I'm glad it wasn't.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting kind of side perspective. I spent 4 years in the New Brunswick Premier's office, and to be honest, at that level and various others, you see these kind of top party brass, quote unquote, promise the world to get these women typically to run, yeah, and then they never deliver, right? They let them down every time. And right. I wonder, as we continue to talk about how the system needs to change, how power needs to decentralize, how do we get past that? And I don't even know how to frame this question. I'm kind of thinking it out loud, but how do we move past the fact, like promising the world and then always letting these, amazing women and diverse candidates down, which it seems like we just keep doing over and over again.
I'm not sure that that's me, because I wasn't promised anything, right? So I don't know how to answer that. So I wasn't let down necessarily by the prime minister or anything like that. So I was let down by the promise made to Canadians that I purchased. Like I bought into that bold, transformative government done differently, sunny ways, open transparency thing. I actually bought that hook, line, and sinker. And so when that didn't materialize in a way So I bought that. Then I also bought the Diversity is Our Strength, Add Women, Change Politics, and thought that, wow, that's intersectional feminism. It's not. It's just two separate hashtags. Don't overthink things, Selena. All right. It's not an academic exercise. This is politics, something totally different. Right. And so I bought what he promised the world, and he promised the world something different. And that's why it was easy to walk away, because I could no longer follow him as a leader, because he wasn't depicting to me. And this is even before the phone call. He wasn't depicting to me what the expectation of keeping promises was, open and transparent, inclusive government was. And then on top of that, I mean, I want to be very clear, which I think people seem to forget, that in addition to all these open, sunny ways, things that he was promising, we got in with a majority government. So if we actually wanted to do open, sunny ways, transparent, and blah, 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 sky's the limit, change the name from Canada to like whatever, Timbuktu, or, you know, take in all the Caribbean islands as our next provinces, we could have done that. Like, if we wanted to do bold stuff, that was the time to do it. If we wanted to repeal mandatory minimums, that was the time to do it. If we wanted to change voting from first past the post, that was the time to do it. If we wanted to expunge records for cannabis possession, that was the time to do it. If we wanted to make sure that equity frameworks were built in so they couldn't get dismantled as soon as the next government changed, that was the time to do it. We did not do that. So you want to be bold, but not really. You want to be transparent, but not too much. You want to be government done differently, but actually want to maintain the status quo. Honestly, it's easy for me to walk away from that because I bought the package. And people always say to me, oh, how's your relationship with Justin? I didn't have a relationship with Justin. We are not friends. We are colleagues. I went to work. I worked with someone named Justin Trudeau, and now I don't. We are not friends. If he wants to have a beer, I'll have a beer with him. But will I ever follow him as a leader? No, I wasn't let down. I was let down by the whole sort of branding that was positioned.
Yeah, no, it's an important distinction. And, you know, I think it's kind of fascinating in some ways, again, that, you know, you talk about the hashtags, right? Add Women, Change Politics, Diversity is Our Strength. But it's hard to find an actual example where Add Women, Change Politics actually materializes in legislation, right? I mean, if we look at Canada, maybe you could say like the BC and, or not the BC, rather the Alberta NDP, maybe.
Perhaps, yes, under but, Notley. Yes.
Right, under Notley. But I think it's just so important to this conversation where in some ways we've been so focused on representation in numbers that we haven't been focused enough on what it actually, one, looks like to operationalize, quite frankly, right? Like,
yes, this is not a performative exercise. This is
right. And it's, again, when we talk about, you know, lived experience and different experiences and empathy, you know, it strikes me that, politics is a culprit, but it's not just politics. We haven't figured out, like our leaders haven't figured out how to operationalize these statements, right? And what that actually looks like and means. But how do we, you know, how do we actually move forward and do that? And how do we move past that conversation of strictly numbers? Because numbers really, you know, great, give yourself a pat on the back, you've done the bare minimum, but how do you actually make change?
So number one, we need to run, but run in packs, right? And it's not just, so we have to run, but we have to run in packs. So yes, there's partially numbers, but it can't just be the numbers, because if representation matters, but the person sitting at the table, nothing matters to them, then get the heck, take several seats, like just get out of the way, right? So I'd rather have somebody there that actually is going to represent what matters to the people and therefore be able to push against the status quo, and someone who's not afraid, it's not just about breaking glass ceilings, right? it's about understanding that when you break glass ceilings, the glass is going to fall and you're going to get cut. So the person sitting there needs to also understand that, has to have, not be afraid to get cut or hurt in the process, because this is hard work. So that's number one. So it's like, part of the responsibility is on this side, where we have to run, we have to have good representation, we have to push people to run that are going to dismantle the status quo. That's only half of the equation, though. The other half of the equation that people are forgetting is that the culture of the institution is so darn toxic that you put these add women, add diversity into this toxic environment that was built on a principle of exclusion, that excluded women, that excluded diverse people, that excluded Indigenous people. And then you want, and then was further reinforced. So that status quo was further reinforced by oppressive and racist policy, like the Indian Act and residential schools and anti-Black immigration policy. So that reinforced this democracy that is now, you know, fortressized, I don't even know if that's a word, by policy that's baked into its exclusion on top of its exclusion. And then you want to just add people and change politics? What the fuck are you talking about? That doesn't even make any sense. This is not only our responsibility, it's the responsibility of the institution to understand fundamentally how it started, right? And then change that. There's no representation of Black people on the parliamentary precinct. None. I walk through that building and I'm just like, save and except for a bunch of pictures that have Black frames, like there really isn't a lot of Black at all, right? So it's like there's an erasure from the consciousness of the heart of our democracy, of the fact that we've been here. Bless Kim Campbell's heart. But every time I walk by her picture, I'd be like, thank God you're here, sis, because I don't know how I can make it through this place without you. And, you know, she'll smile back and I'll be like, yo, peace, man. I don't know why you're hanging up here with them dudes, but yo, if you need me, holler. And I keep walking. Like, I would have this conversation every single time I walk by Kim Campbell's picture, every time, because I was just like, I don't know how you're doing it. Like, how are you still here? So we have to change. Like, we could run all we want. And I think this is why I was so honest while I was there about my experiences, because I was so shockingly surprised. Chapter 10 is embarrassing for me in this book, because I was so surprised by everything. I'm like, this place is, first of all, it's creepy. Like all these, like these guys, just, these frames are like so big. It's like chopped down 15 trees to make a frame. And then it's like, they're staring at me. I'm like, why are your pictures so big? Like, dude, you know, like they didn't expect a lot of you. So they just put like really, really big frames instead of just getting nice little ones. And then you'd walk through and it was just like, it's just stone and concrete. And then the green against my skin tone was just not flattering.
It's not a nice green.
I'm like, whose imagination did this come from? Clearly not a woman. That's all I have to say.
So I want to let folks in. I'm seeing so many head nods. So, you know, hands up, unmute.
There's just a few of us. Everybody jump in. And just jump into this bad boy. Because if you like the green, like, I don't want to diss you. You could just say like, you know, Selena, how dare you talk about the green that way in our House of Commons? But you know what? I do remember when somebody said to me, you know, you have to tell me how it feels when you first walk in there. And they were so gung-ho about it. And I walked in, I was like, Jesus, this green is going to make my skin tone look bad. And when they asked me about it after, I was like, oh, it was great. What a lie. I was lying. Oh my God. It was so bad.
I think that's what I really loved about your book, actually, is that it gave you this sort of embodied sense of what it's like to be there, especially as a newcomer to it, as someone who's not like a career politician who's like, yeah, just entering it. And yeah, I could really, for me, that was one thing I really identified with, was just how weird that place is.
Well, you know what, like, so even walking through, I kept thinking, why does it feel like I have to walk through like this, you know, kind of like, ooh, you know, when like you're walking through a scary movie and they're like, no, don't go into the shower. And I'm like, I'm walking there anyway. Like, I felt like that the whole time. Like, even when I would walk up the stairs, if I was by myself, I'd be like, oh my God, it's creepy in broad daylight, right? And just this, I wanted to sort of contextualize and put to words what that cringe feeling was without saying cringe. You know what I mean? And just give the reader a sense of, for me, it actually felt like they didn't want me there. The building didn't want me there.
I have a question for you. So you're talking about doing politics differently and not holding the status quo. And I don't expect like a full solution, but what would politics look like ideally for you, or democracy? And because that's a question that I'm asking myself and people around me, like, I really think we need to change the system, but what would that system look like? So if you have like pieces of an answer for that.
That's why I left, because I didn't understand what that would look like. I left to think about what that would look like, because I couldn't. So people were like, is it broken? I'm like, well, no, it's not broken. Like, we have a good system, but there's something not right about it. And, you know, I just couldn't be in there trying to figure out what to do and beating my head against the wall and then being in a party that I knew didn't really care for me. But I think what it really boils down to, so when people ask me, so the other question is, when they ask me, Selena, will you go back? And I say, yes, I will go back. So what, under what conditions will you go back? And really the condition I'll go back is when the leadership changes. So maybe it's just leadership or lack thereof, right? Because if you have a leadership that, so it's like, I'm at Queens, like Queens actually had an anti-Black racist policy where they banned Black students from their medical school for 100 years, like from 1918, they just apologized for it in 2018, like 3 years ago. And so, and then I get called, Selena, would you like to come to Queens? I'm like, no, why would I do that? Like, I there's so many worse things I could do with my life. And, but the leadership at Queens with Jane Philpott, with Patrick Dean, they want to change the culture. Do you understand? So if you have a leadership that says, okay, it's not just about putting out like the stuff for our students, putting out policy, if like we were in government, doing the stuff that we really need to do to operationalize things, but also we need to work on internally the structure itself, then I could see myself going back, right? And that's why I went to Queens, because they said, okay, no, we're not just wanting you to come to Queens, we want to change the culture of the institution. I was like, oh, I'm down for that, because we could totally do the day-to-day stuff, but we also have to do the structural stuff too. So I think for me, it's about the leadership. But that's a wait and see, right? So you change the leadership and you have someone who actually understands sort of cultural transformation, intersectional feminism when they're running. And then when you get in there, they see power and they're like, maybe we don't need to do all this stuff because we may not get it reelected. And that's one of the reasons mandatory minimums was not repealed, because it would have polled poorly for us. We would have looked soft on crime. The chances of us getting reelected dropped. So do you do what is politically expedient, or do you do what is right? So it's leadership, term limits, perhaps. I have no idea, but I'm still thinking it through. But the system in and of itself, I don't think the system is broken. I think the operating of the system, there's something wrong with that. And I haven't even touched the bureaucratic side yet. So I'm just talking about the gas that's going into the machine. I'm not talking about the actual engine.
So I absolutely loved your book. I'm very passionate about politics in Canada. And so when I read your book, and I've been in municipal politics for the past decade, and I've worked with provincial and federal government. So I love the feeling of reading and kind of discovering with you, kind of it dawning on you how the sausage is made, you know, and you can't unsee it, you know. It's like, this is terrible.
Oh my God.
It was kind of like a slow motion, like looking around you, you see all the green. Yeah. This is absolutely horrible. So I've had that feeling many times. In New Brunswick, and when I go to Fredericton, and when I go to Ottawa, and it's such an intangible feeling. It's so hard to describe that culture, that toxic culture. And that's why I want to run in politics, but I'm like, I know this bad, bad feeling. And it's like, something is bad. And so when I read your book, I saw kind of beyond just the stories, but the feeling. And I thought she found the words, you know, you found the words to describe it. So I just wanted to ask you, how hard was it to describe that feeling, you know, to find the words to describe your experience just beyond just saying the actual facts? Because I thought you did it so masterfully. And I just thank you so much for just describing that feeling.
thank you for that. So I would say that especially in the last year. So in the last year, I really started writing a lot in 2019. And no, I would say from 2018, maybe 2018, I started writing a lot because, you know, things just started getting so heavy that I could not hold it in. And I had to write, you know, when I'm on a plane or I'm on the train and I'm just typing. And I'm just typing like so I could look back on it. So I just typed how the details of the moment, right? So I had all of the sort of details as accurately as I could remember them. And then when you're writing the book now I have to go back and feel that moment, right? So I have to now have to think of a way to feel the moment that I know is accurate in terms of context. But then it's like reading the ingredients list on the back of the cereal box, right? But when you feel that, you know, you go in and you have to crunch the wheat and then the wheat makes the powdered texture in your hands and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? Then you have to like put that in there. So because I'd written a lot of it, like as a cathartic experience, just to flush it out, I remember my editor, Ann Collins, saying to me, you know, after she saw some of the stuff that happened in 2019, she's like, I can't publish this. And I'm like, yes, you can. I'm angry and you're going to publish that. And she's like, no, this is like really like you're mad. We can't publish this. And then she said, do you want the book to hurt or to heal? So that I had to go back and write the book from a perspective of a feeling. So even when I'm talking about how I used to suspend myself and watch my parents and talk about the haunt and talk about some of these things, I had to remember how I felt in those moments. So I could write the story, but I need to talk about how I felt. And I feel like if I was writing a book to heal, then people had to feel the book, not read the book. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so I don't know how I did that, to be honest. I just wanted people to feel it. So I've written this book maybe at least 10 or 11 times by the time it gets to this. And then like, this is my version, right? It's still like, did you write it, lady? Because you have a lot of notes in a book that you wrote. But I've read it again. I've read it a couple of times again in this form because I'm always looking for the spelling mistakes, which there is some in here. And I'm looking for like, I always want to make sure that I felt what I think I felt. So I think about it later and I'll go back and read it. And I was like, yeah, that's what I felt. Right. And then I read it again and go, I get to the end and be like, oh yeah, that was so good. And then I'll be like, I need to put some more, like, I don't want it to end. What more do I have to say? What more do I have to say? I don't want it to end. I don't want it to end. I'm like, I have nothing more to say. I have nothing more to say. Maybe I could write more about, no, I have nothing more to say about that. And then I'll be like, no, it's done. So the amount of times I've done that and be like, I don't want this book to end. I have to say something else. I have to say something else. And it's like, I have nothing more to say. How do you have nothing more to say? I have nothing more to say. I don't know what to say. I have nothing more to say. And then that was it. And then I knew it was done. So when people ask me about the next book, I'm like, I have nothing more to say.
So there's two ideas that I had highlighted in the book, which of course I loved every minute of it, but, and they're kind of connected to a lot of the things you were saying just tonight. And one was around fiddling around the edges rather than attacking the structures. And the second one, which I think is probably one of my favorite kind of ideas that you put forward, is you didn't want to become someone who is occupying space but not standing for anything. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if kind of like, do you think that that's something that happens to people over time that are stuck in this structure that sort of makes the path of least resistance to just only fiddle? And you think that people like come in with big ideas and big aspirations and sort of get pushed to the middle or pushed to fiddle or whatever it is. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, is that something that was one of the hardest things for you to hold on to, that idea of wanting to really stand and make sure that you didn't kind of fall?
Yes, the answer to that is absolutely yes, 100%. It always amazes me when people get the book, like when they get it. Going back to your first question, Katie, around what would you have said to me 5 years ago if I said you were going to write this book? I said, no, I'm not a writer. So when people get it, so I'm so shocked, not because people are like unintelligent, but it's just like, did I say what I wanted people to say in a way that they could understand what I'm saying? And so, yes, the whole time that I was there, I kept thinking, so hold on. So the second part first, occupying space and not standing for anything. So the first 2 years of me being in politics, I felt like I was occupying space. So chapter 10, chapter 11, just occupying space, you know, trying to do stuff from the inside, but it's like feeling like I was hitting my head against the wall. Like, okay, so here's a framework. I'm giving you like the word, no, I don't want your framework. Okay, so I'm going to do this. No, okay, cool. I'm going to talk about the UN decade for people of African descent, but thanks, little lady. And you know, nothing would happen. And then I was excluded and then, you know, didn't hear anything. And then 2018 comes and it's like, yeah, but I gave you the idea. And then you just took it from me and you ran with it. And now, so in September of 2017, I made a very, very conscious decision. And I remember talking to my husband about it. And it was like after the summer break, you come back in September 2017, I said to my husband, the gloves come off. And he's like, okay, whoa, everybody calm down. You do not have to drop all of it. I said, no, they're going to get all of Selena. I said, I'm done occupying space. And for the first 2 years, that fiddling around the edges is what happens, I think, in to a lot of women in these kinds of spaces where it's like, don't worry your pretty little head over that, sweetie. You know, it's just like short of tapping me on my head. Like it was almost like, you just wait your turn, Selena. No, yeah, I know we promised mandatory minimums, but can you just wait your turn? You're not going to get mandatory minimums right now. Just wait. And I was like, point that fucking finger in my face one more time, bitch. But like, you know, I tried to be nice. I honestly tried to be nice for those first 2 years. And then I was like, first of all, it was killing me. Like it actually was, and I kept thinking, is this my mental health? And that chapter 10, is it my mental health? Is it like, what's happening? Like, what is happening to me? Like, I felt like I was completely falling apart. And then I kept saying to my husband, whatever is happening here, it's going to kill me. It's killing me. And then the guy died at his desk in Parliament, like during the first like year. And I was like, oh my God, it could actually kill me. I don't know what it is, but it actually killed somebody here. And they found him. My God. And then I start to panic because I'm like, Jesus. So it could actually kill you. And I feel it. I know whatever it is. It's like, I feel my heart, like something is deteriorating inside. Like actually I felt physically like it was killing me. And I was just saying to my husband, no way. I'll be damned if I die here. I'm too cute to die here. I can't do that. And so I said, the gloves come off and he was like, babe, we don't want that kind of smoke. Nobody wants that kind of smoke. And I was like, well, sorry. So yeah. So then I just decided that's it. I'm just going to do politics a different way. Again, nobody asked me to be here. Nobody flew across the country. There were no rules because this place wasn't designed for me. So I don't know whose structure this is that was stupid enough to let me in, but y'all can't fire me. So there. And here I am. And then I just decided to have some fun with it. And fun with it, meaning that I was now speaking up for the most vulnerable person in our society, meaning the person with multiple intersecting identities who wasn't voiceless, but who often speaks in a whisper or speaks and then is silenced, is given the, not just yet, honey, just wait a minute, that person. And I was just like, you know, damn y'all, I'm not doing that. So nobody's gonna, so that's when I came in with my braids. And that was week one of Selena showing up. And then it was Maxime Bernier. And then it was like, it was a fiasco after that. But I'm glad I showed up then, because then it made Maxime a lot easier to deal with. As difficult as it was, it made him easier to deal with, because I was like, dude, what? You're not making any sense. And yeah, so I think there's only two things that could happen to people in politics, to be honest, under a certain leadership, is that they either get ground into the fabric of the place, in which case it's very difficult to stand up because you're so ground down that you just have to say yes or no, or yes or no. But, and then if you go against the machine, if you rail against the machine, it grinds through you. So I had to leave. I could not stay in there and let it keep grinding against me. It was very painful, but I was gonna like bring down the whole thing with me on my exit. It's like, if you're gonna let me go down, I'm taking the whole thing down with me. And that was an interesting ride, because I wasn't expecting SNC. And it was interesting because, and I wish I published the speech that I gave at the Robbie Burns. Like, I wish I published the Robbie Burns speech, because that was freaking epic. And it actually was the foreshadow for SNC. And I didn't know SNC was happening. And Jody was killing herself. Jane was like dying. And I'm like, this is like, it's funny, but it's not that funny. Little did I know how actually funny it was.
You're talking about getting more people like running in packs and kind of changing the system from the inside. I know you haven't really touched that in your book, but I'm wondering if you see ways of change, or maybe not changing, but making sure the system is not as toxic as it is from the outside, and maybe from your experience as a member of parliament, like, were there any events or people that you met that really made an impression and were able to bring change? And like, how did it happen? Like, what can we learn from that? If you want, I know that's not the topic of your book, but.
Oh, that's totally good.
I'm always interested in that.
So, I wrote this story so that people could have sort of a blueprint of understanding the inside, so that when they ran in packs, they were like, okay, so we shouldn't be surprised that we're going to get resistance, right? So check. We're going to get resistance. We're going to get cut. We're going to like all this stuff. Right. But it's interesting. And I don't talk about her in the book, and I've been very sort of protective over our, I won't even say friendship. I'm very particular when I use the word friend, but the acquaintance that we have. And there is no person I'm more misaligned with politically than Michelle Rempel. Totally. Politically wise, just there's sometimes that she says and does, and I'm like, are you kidding? You have to be kidding. But the one person that saved me during most of that time was Michelle Rempel, who would send the note, who would be like, you can't be afraid that they're going to call you the angry Black woman, because they're going to talk about you anyway, Selena. They're going to talk about you. You know that, right? And I'm like, no, they're not going to talk about me. Everybody loves me. She's like, you're stupid. They're going to talk about you. And so, you know, she'd send me these little notes, and I'd be like, I was almost afraid of them, because you're told that if the opposition talked, like, they're the enemy and they're going to, like, you know, try to brainwash you. I don't know what they were supposed to do. I don't know. But you just get this feeling like you should not talk to them. And then of all people, Michelle Rempel, I remember when the first time she came to talk to me, she was like walking towards me and I was like walking faster. I'm like, oh God, please don't let her come. Please don't. But let me tell you, when the chips were down and I got a note from someone, it was her. And it would be like, you're a fucking badass. Don't you even think about stopping right now. And I'd be like, okay, Michelle, I won't stop. So I think we need to really just think about the rules, the unwritten rules of politics differently. And if I were to go back and do it again, I wouldn't hide that Michelle and I would have like these little secret conversations. I wouldn't like see her and be like doing all these like baseball stupid symbols, right? like I can't talk to you right now, but meet me at the back of the coordinates 3497 north 657 east. Why? It's so dumb. Like just forget all those unwritten rules were written for us and we absorbed them like they were, and they were not. This was written by someone who put green on the chairs. Can't trust that guy.
I mean, when you were, you know, pulling everything with you, you should have grabbed on to all the carpet and just rolled it out.
But they redid the whole West Block. And I was like, they would end up charging me for that. So that I don't have that. I'm not doing that. No, let somebody else pay for that.
Thank you so much. Really quickly, one of the things that really the whole descriptor for the book was of course, this is exactly what it is. It's so transparent. It's unapologetic. It's you. I don't know you, but I feel I know you. But to go from what I would consider most of us normal to this is a journey, like to be so transparent and to overcome the shame and et cetera. How do you even start?
That's the question. I'm like, give me more so I can think about it.
Yeah, sorry. I just kept thinking like, obviously I'm a white woman, highly privileged, but I could relate to a lot of the points. And I kept thinking, I don't know that I could come out this way so publicly about these things, even though we share these things. Like, there are parts of me that we share that I would never come out and say publicly. And I was like, how do you get there? Not only to say it, but to publish it in a book. Yeah. Right? Like it's a next level courage. And I've been thinking about it since I read it. So I thought I would ask you, how does one get there?
I wish I had an easy answer for you. You know, it's interesting. That last year was so painfully hard, right? And so maybe I do have an easy answer for you, because and you have to use like an analogy, right? So imagine I'm holding a cup, and I remember at one point in the last couple of years, so I talk about my husband and my like challenges in our marriage, and I remember like even in the last couple of years saying to him, I don't have capacity for you. I have to finish this role as my MP, so I have my work in my cup and I have to look after my children. I have no capacity for you, and I don't have capacity for me in my cup, right? And so as great as our marriage was, even after, like during politics, it wasn't that great. So the book gives like a semi-glossed over version of the reality. And so as I started writing this book, and one of the reasons why I think journaling now is so therapeutic, even though I don't really do it a lot, I just do it when I need to purge. This was a purge. So the more I wrote, so that I'd write pieces of the book, and then my editor will go, there's a gap here and here and here. And I'll be like, yeah. I'm like, how'd you know? And she'd be like, because I'm a good editor, Selena. What is supposed to be here, here, and here? And I'm like, I don't want to tell you. And as I started writing, and I say it's painful, like, you know, the assault or the abortion or, you know, the affair or whatever. And then as I started to write pieces of it down, my cup started getting more and more empty. And then I realized when I finished the book, that my cup wasn't actually full. It just had junk in it. It had all this stuff that I was holding from like my childhood, from like just shit that, you know, just get rid of it all. Keeps holding and holding and holding and holding. And even if I just wrote it all down and then burned it, right? Just the fact that I just let it go, and then I was able to put my husband back in my cup, and most importantly, myself back into my cup, because I was not like being consumed by all the garbage that was in there. And so now it's like, how was I able to do that? I wrote it in, well, I had a really good editor, but I wrote what I needed to get rid of. I needed to get rid of a lot of stuff that just was starting to consume parts of me that I didn't want it to consume anymore. You know, and to be honest, I don't think that I've even unpacked like the political side yet, because I was talking with someone about grief, and you know, she was saying, well, have you grieved leaving politics? And I'm like, well, I don't know, because I'm still angry. Like, I see Justin Trudeau on TV and I instantly either am angry or I start to cry. I hear his voice, I start to cry. Like, I'm really still triggered. Like, this was a terrible moment for me, right? And I'm thinking, like, you know, there's things that I just needed to get rid of. And so it was more for me than it was. It was for me, but I knew that the parts that I put in would be very therapeutic for a lot of people. If it was therapeutic for me, so there's stories that I could have put in there, and I could have just written this book writing about, you know, all my awards. Like, the awards are sort of an afterthought in my depressive state, right? But they're not like a whole story around what I did to get the Toronto Board of Trade Award. There's no whole story around, you know, the Business Association Awards. There's a whole story about, you know, speaking at the Drug Information Association. There isn't a story around there, because I didn't want that to be the story. I needed to purge, and I needed people to heal. I needed to let people know where the pain came from that led to the passion, and the hurt was that is the purpose. And why I will never be unwavering in my principles, because it is tied to pain. When I see Jody like being hung out to dry, that is tied to a pain that I have that could be empathetic for her. And so that is what I wanted in the story. And yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if it makes any of it makes sense, but that's, the pain is my whole, is anchors my purpose, because I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the pain that, and the hurt and the guilt and the shame. As I said, it's always right behind my eyeballs. Never forget it. So when people say, oh, you need to stop going so hard against the government, against blah, 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 I'm like, hell no. I'm not asking for repealing mandatory minimums because I plan on going into jail. I do it because I know that it hurts people, it hurts their families. And it could have been me. It could have been me, like at any one of those points in my life, it could have been me. Like, I just happened to, I don't know, the right door opened at the right time. And I stupidly walked through the right door, because if the wrong door opened, I could have been hoping that some Selena out there repeals mandatory minimums and stops me from rotting in jail. Yeah, so it's a pain that's driving this.
Thank you so much. This has been incredible conversation. It's, you know, really, I think, such an honor for us to get to kind of digest your words with you and share this conversation with you. So thank you so much for spending so much time with us tonight. It was so great. And again, I think all really enjoyed your book so much. So thank you for having that courage and sharing with us. I think we'll hopefully all find a bit more of that within ourselves now.
Yeah, just thank you so much. And each of you, thank you so much for taking the time to read it. Just thank you. And thank you, like, just for using your platform for empathy. I keep saying that if we do nothing in after 2020, if we just have the empathy such that 20, 30 years from now, you could remember this moment and record a history that doesn't erase from the consciousness or the institutions or the stories of Canadians, things that happens to people who look like me. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of our history books don't have anything about us. They don't have stuff that connects us as people. And so if we just have the empathy, that's all I'm asking people for, the empathy to remember that we just want things to be fair. That's all.
Thanks so much for sticking with us. And if you liked this episode, share it. You can connect with us on social media at FemWonk, and I'll see you next time.